Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And in line with many of the shows we've kind of covered this week, I've actually gotten, I'll just say, a little bit of feedback, or at least we got Paul with us. Welcome back, Paul. Happy New Year, by the way.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Happy New Year.
And in doing the shows, Paul had come up with a few questions and or comments, and I said, well, you know what, let's cover this, because I don't want to go too far beyond the General Assembly and or Anna von Ritz or the Sovereign Citizen Movement, because I want to make sure we kind of, you know, put the final nail in the coffin here. Bottom line, this movement is literally misleading and lying to people and misrepresenting actually our government, because everything that they're relying upon is all based on the government that we abandoned. And as I've laid this out, and I say this, we no longer have a top-down government. We don't have a magistrate form of government where we have a sovereign who reigns from on high. We actually dismantled that paradigm. The problem was that James Madison and company didn't lay out, hey, we no longer, you know, will adhere to these things. The General Assembly, the committees of safety is no longer, we created a system where we've actually not abolished it, we actually integrated that into the government itself, which is why you don't have committees of safety. You have a county supervisors. You have a board of supervisors or a board of commissioners at your county level. You now have representatives governing and protecting you full time. And at the state right. level, you have representatives representing and protecting you and your county, both at the House as well as the Senate, so that they created this perfect model of representation. Mm-hmm. So the need for people to band up and resist, you know, the tyranny from on high completely went away. The problem is that all of a sudden people go, well, hold on here. You know, we don't recognize what's going on, and we don't see how they go, you know, so they make this assumption that they legitimately created these powers, that the Constitution itself, and, you know, I know that there's these nuances where they like to play these magical word games that, oh, well, we kind of accept the Constitution, but we're doing things that are absolutely contrary to, you know, to the Constitution. And so what I need to do, and I'm soliciting your help, because since I've got you on the hook now. I'd like to actually go through some of these documents, because as we, you know, down the road, I want people to really look at what these people are saying. I mean, you got this small team of 20 people out of a county of, I don't know how many thousands, that claim that they represent that county. You know, how'd that happen? Did they have an election? No, these people take it upon themselves. In other words, they're applying the paradigm or the concept of a General Assembly or the right of the people to band together to resist government. That is the doctrine of magistrates. That is that process of doing that. In America and under our Constitution, we actually have a constitutional process, and it's called the right of petition. And you have a right to petition your representatives. And that's how, if you have a problem with government, that is the process. Just because you didn't learn that and you don't know the Constitution doesn't mean you can dig up archaic, you know, documents of, you know, the pre-constitutional era and go, oh, well, this is what we can do. No, that was abandoned. They created a much better system. So I know you came up with some questions, and so let's kind of go through those first. Sure.
Listening to your show this week, it came up with a couple of things that kind of just pinged me. Here's the first one. On Monday, you were talking, you made a mention, we're talking about the beginnings of the Republic, and one of the things you said was that the people were ignorant. Uneducated. Remember that?
Yes.
And that they were uneducated, and that surprised me. I'll tell you why. You're familiar with de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, right?
Yes, yes, correct.
And one of the things that he observed was that Americans were so knowledgeable about their form of government that he felt it was remarkable.
Okay, so yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, having read that book a few times, what Alexis de Tocqueville was noting was it was remarkable to see such illiteracy in America, yet the people understood in some fashion their government regarding their rights and those types of things. And actually, his conclusion was America is great not because, you know, it is educated or, you know, it has these great, you know, features. America is great because it is good. In other words, the people were righteous, they were humble, and they were, you know, I'll just say, not subservient, but they were good, righteous people. He noticed that where the people, where you could really see the essence of the people wasn't in the city halls. It wasn't in the courts. Mm-hmm. They said that where you could see the essence of our society was in the churches. Because you got to remember, at Alexis de Tocqueville, when he came to America, the abandonment of religion and churches in Europe had already begun.
Okay.
And so they were turning their back on, you know, that bedrock of their society, and they were going godless, where he recognized that America was not going down that path.
Okay. That's the other thing is I'm really glad that you read that several times, because there's a quote going around and it claims to have been debunked. America is you may be familiar with it. America isn't good because it is great. It is great because it is good.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and so, there was a way that he actually wrote that, but what he was literally referring to was that the strength of America had nothing to do with its laws and its political power. It had everything to do with its spiritual righteousness of the people. In other words, we didn't need a lot of laws to, you know, behave so well and to work with each other. Because we were Christian, because we were godly, we were able to resolve problems without having to create laws for this and laws for that. See, when you go godless, all of a sudden, when you abandon God's law, you have to start injecting man's law. You know, you can actually look at the registry of laws, the Federal Registry of Laws, and as we turned away, you know, from the churches and started moving godless. And the beginning of that was in the 1850s, middle 1800s, middle of the 19th century. And so it doesn't happen overnight to where all of a sudden we have this need for a whole bunch of laws. But it took a few decades. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until the early 1900s when they, you know, the progressive era had begun and godlessness was really being unleashed, because it was 1920 when they finally closed, because they were actually still teaching creation in the education system in the 1920s. And the communists, mm-hmm. the Fabian Society, knew that that was one of their biggest targets. And this is why the Scopes trial was injected by a atheist. Well, so I believe the guy was considered a non-atheist, but, you know, this guy was an activist. And, you know, all of these godless activists lied. They misrepresented themselves all the time because they knew they would get zero sympathy from the people or from the court if they came right out and said, yeah, I worship Satan.
Right.
I mean, okay. It's defeatist. It's defeatist to your cause. So, but the reality is that the Scopes trial was really that point in time, and in America's migration away to becoming godless, where the federal courts and the federal government at that time basically, that's when they lowered the boom and forced America to no longer allow, you know, free thought in the school, and said, you will teach evolution.
That's interesting. So what happened is America, in the early days of the Republic, America was good because the people were also self-governing. And then what comes to mind, I don't want to lose this point. It's right on the edge of my tongue. Okay. Now I remember. What comes to mind is this. So America was self-governing, and in the early days, the nation, they recognized Christianity, even though the Constitution did not allow the government to establish a religion. Okay, people lived Christian principles. But then later on this week, you're quoting Madison. Uh-huh. And Madison, remember, Madison chided himself for seeking a day of prayer and fasting and said that he didn't want to even impose his own religion on the people. Remember that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So he didn't want to do that. So interestingly, because you made a point and it stood out, you made a point that even though people may claim that America is a Christian nation, or they may claim that the Constitution is a Christian document, okay, it really is a neutral document in so much that, and I'm telling you, I know this may be hard for a lot of people to get around when you say, because Madison himself didn't want to force his own religious viewpoints
right.
on the representatives, on the people, on the states.
Right.
And so when you don't take, let me put it this way. Remember when Moses leads the Israelites out of Egypt. Why was that? One, they were enslaved. Two, how could they worship God if they were enslaved? In other words, they had to get out of a government that suppressed their religious views so they could worship freely. And so what we do, I think what the Constitution allows us to do is to worship as we please. And it's a neutral document. I guess what I'm trying to say, GR, is it's a neutral document in terms of religion. And if we seek to enforce our religious views, or even a community seeks to enforce our religious views nationally, then we run the risk of having it come back to bite us. And I think that's where we are with being forced now, for example, as you point out, to to teach evolution.
Yeah.
Did I make any sense?
Yeah, it does. But let's re-examine America, and let's re-examine, you know, some of these framers, because the United States was not a Christian nation. It was not a Christian assembly of nations.
Okay.
It was a nation assembled by Christian nations. What do I mean by that? At the day of the ratification of the Constitution, in other words, when the federal government formed in 1789, how many of those states out of the 13 were, you know, not Christian? In other words, let me be very specific. How many states actually had an involvement, a direct involvement of their state-sponsored church in their government?
Oh, I would think almost all of them.
They all did.
Because, the churches are what did what we consider welfare. They did compassionate service, and right?
Yes, correct. Correct. As a matter of fact, the churches were, you know, in charge of and managed the education system. They managed what, you know, the shambles of our medicine, our healthcare system, welfare. That was all done. You remember when we read, because you read the cod fishery bounties and how how Madison used the shock value. If you could do this, then we could do this, 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 and this. And this just put everybody at a gasp, because he was pointing out that, you know, what you're saying is if we can use the purse to do anything, then the next thing you know, we'll actually be putting teachers in the schools and running churches. And that's what, we would never go there. And look at where we are today. And so I actually laid this out in my first book. But if you actually go through, there was only two states that abandoned their Christian, their affiliation as a state with a Christian denomination. And that was Delaware in 1792. That's when they abandoned their entanglements with the church. And that was a Christian non-denominational church. The other state was in 1798, and that was Georgia. And that was the Protestant faith. They had a Protestant church.
Okay.
I take that back. Pennsylvania was a Christian non-denominational. They were the first, actually, in 1790. So there were three states. Okay. But after that, when you look, it was, 1830, 1833, 1818 was Connecticut. And
what did they do in its place?
More important, let me give you the last state.
Okay.
And the last state was New Hampshire. In 1877, they abandoned their church affiliations.
Okay.
And so what did they do instead is they actually let it fail. In other words, they just turned their back on compassionate services. And they just let the local communities do whatever they wanted to do. The state no longer utilized, you know, the taxes that they were taking from the people to kind of help, you know, promote their church. But one of the problems, because the reason why James Madison wrote this remonstrance on religion was because in Virginia, the Anglican Church was actually going after Baptists and other missionary work where people were proselyting, you know, a different faith. They were arresting them because you have to have an angelical license to do that. And so they were imprisoning these other people. And he says,
said angelical, or did you mean Anglican?
Anglican, I'm sorry. You're right. Anglican.
Yeah, okay.
You're right.
Okay.
I probably did say angelical. but let's unravel this a little bit further. In that very same book, Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, Alexis de Tocqueville acknowledges, and as a matter of fact, let me see if I can find the quote real quick. He acknowledges that, let me see here. Yes, this is, I got the quote right here. This is out of Democracy in America. Quote, while I was in America, a witness who happened to be called at the assizes of the county of Chester, state of New York, declared that he did not believe in the existence of God or in the immortality of the soul. The judge refused to admit his evidence on the ground that on the ground that the witness had destroyed beforehand all the confidence of the court in what he was about to say. So this is what the newspaper related. And he basically says this, the Court of Common Pleas of Chester, New York, a few days since rejected a witness who declared his disbeliefs in the existence of God. The presiding judge remarked that he had not before been aware that there was a man living who did not believe in the existence of God, that this belief constituted the sanction of all testimony in a court of justice, and that he knew of no cause in a Christian country where a witness had been permitted to testify without such disbelief. Now, Joseph Story also basically, and how long was Joseph Story on the Supreme Court?
I don't know.
1940 or 1845 is when he died. So, and he died in service of the court. And in his memoirs, he actually talks about why the court system did not allow non-believers, infidels, to basically have a case in court. You were denied justice in America.
Okay.
You had to be a person, a Christian in good standing. In other words,
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So, in other words, go ahead.
I believe the reason for that was that the Christians believed that they would be judged in the next world, and because of that, it guided your actions in this world. And for that reason, if you failed to feed that to understand that you were accountable in the next life for your actions in this one,
mm-hmm.
that you weren't to be trusted in court. That's what I understood. Was it something like that?
So this is actually out of his book, and this is a quote.
Okay.
The error of the common law was in reality of a different character. It tolerated nothing but Christianity, as taught by its own established church, either Protestant or Catholic. It was unrelenting severity consigned with the conscious heretic to the stake regarding his very scruples of proofs and irreparable wickedness. What he basically said, and this is in the Life and Letters of Joseph Story, that infidels and pagans were banished from the halls of justice as unworthy of credit. In other words, they couldn't be considered to be truthful. That's why they referred to them as pagans or infidels. They had to be Christian. And so, anyway, the whole point that, you know, when I make this comment that America was not founded on the Christian, you know, faith, as a matter of fact, the United States government was designed not to actually establish a faith, so that states could actually have the freedom to establish a religion if they wanted to. But it had to be congruent, or it had to be in harmony with pure liberty. In other words, when I say pure liberty, the liberty of Christ, where all people have the full free agency. In other words, you know, the concept of a theocracy, we're almost out of time. The concept of a theocracy is, you know, repugnant to our constitutional principles. So with that, I'll let you stew on that, because we're going into break. And so when we come back, we'll kind of pick this thing back up, because, you know, obviously diving into, you know, our form of history, because most people that are out there, you know, well, I'm going to bleed into the break. So I'll be right back, folks, after this break. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I'm not sure if, you know, if we're diving too far into this, but the whole point behind the Constitution and the Establishment Clause that was put into the Bill of Rights right up front, that the general government, the federal government, would not establish a religion, make no law establishing a religion. This, what this did was it, because the Puritans, these states would not have joined the Union if they were going to be forced to actually convert to a different religion, like the Anglican Church. As a matter of fact, out of all of these churches or out of all of these states, I think the Anglican Church was the dominant one, if that makes sense.
Wasn't the Anglican Church the Church of England?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Okay.
And so the Catholic Church was, you know, you notice that there was no state that was a Catholic church. As a matter of fact, Catholics were really not welcome in America at that point in time. So let me see. One, two, three, four, five out of the 13. So that was the most dominant. There were non-Christian, non-denominationals. There's one, two, three of those. And then there were congressional churches, one, two, three of those, Protestant. So, in other words,
you mean congregational churches?
Yes,
said congressional.
I said, yeah, congregational. Yeah, correct, congregational. Yes.
Okay.
So, other than misstating things, the whole point was that these churches, because there was not, it wasn't like there was 10 Anglican churches.
Right.
There were, you know, only five. So they knew that they couldn't join together. I always say this, that the miracle that occurred in the Americas were that the framers were men that were willing to do two things that we have a hard time doing today. We have it's almost impossible to get a person to put aside their differences, whether they be religious, ideological, you know, political, what have you. Put aside your differences to work with other people on the core common principles of liberty, blah, blah, blah. Putting aside the differences is the first thing that they had to do. The second thing they had to do was to put aside their self-interests.
Okay.
And so they weren't out there trying to, you know, how can I make money out of this? How can I turn around and make a lifestyle out of this? You know, and that's why you see in the conservative ranks, everybody is out there, you know, they're doing it for the money. They're doing it for their own self-interests. Organizations do this. And as a matter of fact, the one thing I have discovered is once you create an organization where there's money involved and everything else, you have a high propensity of becoming, I'll just say, self-involved. In other words, you become focused on your self-relevance and maintaining relevance. And this is very heir apparent in a lot of the organizations that have been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So Anyway, the intent was to create a nation that allowed the states, the agency, or the people of the states to do what they wanted to do. So when new states joined the union, such as Vermont, well, Vermont joined the union as whatever their faith was out in New Hampshire. New Hampshire was the congressional church. So I believe that
congregational.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
So when we look at Vermont joining the union, they probably also had the congregational church as a center part of that state government.
Okay.
Other states did that. As a matter of fact, as we went through, you know, the states joining the union, I believe it was heir apparent that when Utah was going to join the union, Utah was probably going to be a Mormon state. I mean, in other words, the Mormon church was going to be, the faith of the people and of the government. Does that make sense? So,
yes.
So, the abandonment of religion by the states had to be on their own determination. And so it took them a long time. And when you look at many of these states in clinging on to these things, you know, that was either for their and I'll even say it was really for their good. The worst thing that they did was they abandoned their religion the way they did. Instead of abandoning religion, they should have opened the market up to say, we're not going to be dedicated to this. We are going to be dedicated to these fundamental religious principles of liberty, you know, and justice and so forth. And, you know, we are going to encourage, you know, the involvement of religion to continue in compassionate services. And instead of taking, you know, the taxes and donating it only to one church, we will, you know, basically look at the churches and see how much, you know, they're bringing in from their people and doing good with that. And then we will help supplement that instead of just, you know, focusing on supplementing one church.
In other words,
kind of creating a competition of who could serve the people the best, who could actually uplift the people and create a more self-sustaining society. Because the righteous part of Christianity is that, you know, we're to self-sustain. I mean, we're to take care of our own self.
Right.
And
self-sustaining
it. And help others and be compassionate in helping others obtain that same status.
Sure. Self-governing and self-sustaining. And so something, GR, got lost somewhere as the religions, the states were abandoning their religions.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what's happened is they've been replaced with a new godless religion. Still a religion.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. It's just godless.
And okay. So I don't know if we just ran this, you know, to full accord or, you know, ran this down to ground. But, you know, when people talk about common law, and as Joseph Story was saying, common law in England was biblically based.
Oh, that's the other thing that I wanted to get to, that because you refer to it as the flaw of common law, right?
No, I didn't refer to it. I believe that was what Joseph Story did.
Okay, sorry about that. I heard that, and I wanted to address that. So I think that's where you're going. So I'll, right? Okay.
So Story basically was making this this problem that, you know, we can't rely on the Bible as the common law anymore. We have to rely upon the Constitution as the common law. In other words, so you got to look at the one thing that stands immutable with common law in the Bible, in biblical common law, is you can't change God's law, you know, and what you do is you kind of interpret or what have you to try to determine what God's law really is. But instead of using God's law as the foundation, we use the Constitution. In other words, the only thing that is immutable are those things that are delegated or defined within that Constitution. Everything else is left to the states and to the people, respectively. This is just like the 10th Amendment.
But one of the things I think we ought to point out is that I don't know if it's a miracle or providence, is that the Republic, the Constitution, does not subvert God's law. Right?
The Constitution does not subvert. Absolutely, that is correct. What it does is it allows all people to have an open dialogue and an open exchange. Now, I'm on the record of saying that if you understand the Constitution and you have a religious belief or a religious ideology or, you know, a paradigm that is not embracing individual liberty and individual sovereignty, and you embrace something, you know, an invoked law that forces or compels people to do something or to be a certain way or to behave a certain way, then that is non-compatible with the Constitution. It is not compatible with a citizen of this nation. You, in other words, you can't be a citizen if you have a communist ideology. You should not be a citizen. If you believe that the government should be able to dictate everything in your life and take away your liberty, then you have no business being a U.S. citizen.
Wow, we've got a lot of people in office who...
Well, I understand that. And this is why they're all snickering and mocking us. It's the same thing with Islam and Sharia law and all of that. If you actually, because I mean, you do realize that if you accept Allah and then you convert to Christianity, what's the punishment for that under the law of Islam? Death. That, you know, sorry, we believe every person has the agency to choose for themselves what religion they want to be. And Sharia law and Islam is not compatible with our Constitution and our way of life of individual liberty and individual sovereignty. This is why the framers banned Islam. I mean, the first Muslim mosque wasn't even created until like the 1930s, when these godless, nefarious men started actually, you know, creating these little cracks in our system where they started ignoring the bans, or because the bans weren't established in the state or what have you. But Muslims were not allowed to immigrate into any of the states. As a matter of fact, when you look at the standards of all of these churches in these states that had this involvement, they banned the open practice of Judaism or the Hebrew Jews. They could not openly practice in most of the states.
Why was that?
They only allowed the practice of Christianity.
Okay.
So going back to the very beginning of what I said, were these states Christian states when they were banning all other forms of religion other than Christianity? I mean, it was only in America where the open concept, I think it was Maryland, Pennsylvania, and maybe one other state that was open to allowing other faiths to openly practice, but it still had to be Christian. They still banned these other forms of faiths.
Okay. So this is just part of their historical record.
This is just history, right? This is our history. Yeah. And it took time for them to become more accepting of different ideologies because, you know, ignorance creates biases. Ignorance creates bad decisions, right? I mean, most people, when you look at racists, it's only because they're just ignorant.
Okay.
And so as we actually start learning and understanding that, you know, there's not much difference. People are people are people. Then we start learning that, you know, what drives people is those building blocks that, you know, how they've been taught, how they've been raised, you know, what they believe in, those types of things that really kind of sever or make us different.
Okay.
And so hopefully this helps. But anyway, back to the questions that you had regarding the shows. We talked about Alexis de Tocqueville and what was your next?
We talked about the educated citizenry. And so you helped clear that up. Incidentally, a poorly educated person back then was much more educated than a well-educated person today. But that's a rat hole I probably don't want to go down right now. I got a couple other questions for you. And this was, you were talking about the Tory Act. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening to this, and I'm essentially stunned by what I heard, because what they were doing was they were confiscating arms from Tories.
Yes.
You talked about this on Tuesday, and so mm-hmm. It takes me for a loop, because I said, I'm looking at what's going on today.
Uh-huh.
And I said, how could they do that back then? I said, what were they thinking? I mean, these were still their countrymen. They're still in the United States. They're proposing now. In the first instance, there was a proposition that went out to the colonies about disarming loyalists, and apparently the colonies wrote back and said, "You must be nuts." Right?
Right. So, yeah, the very first one, which was, I think, October, basically said you need to go out and arrest anybody that's a British loyalist. And let's look at what was really happening. Let's take a macro view. We had 13 colonies. Almost all were descendants, other than New York, that they probably had, you know, a little bit of descendancy from Denmark or Dutch, right? So, okay, you had that, but all the rest of the colonies were pretty much all English, but they came from different walks or different focuses, you know, like some were founded on religious persecution, such as Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and so forth, but many of the other ones were really, you know, I'll just say commercial endeavors. They were enterprises that were, you know, chartered and created for, you know, the mercantile system. One was actually a penal colony, right? Georgia was a penal colony, or basically it gave people their freedom to come over as an indentured servant and then become, you know, a participant in the American system, giving them 10 acres and, you know, a plot of land. Right. Anyway, so when we look at the macro of what was happening in America, you know, these were all Englishmen. As a matter of fact, John Jay basically sums this up in Federalist Paper number 2. We're all the same people. We all basically have the same religion. In other words, you know, there was such, it wasn't true, let me see, homogeneous is singular and heterogeneous is multiple. Is that right?
Okay.
And so we were more homogeneous than we were heterogeneous. And so most people had that same, you know, core principles. There were differences, and there were unique differences between them, but they were basically trying to say, look, we're not really that different. It's not like, you know, Spaniards and the Roman Catholic Church to the south of us. You know, we're all, you know, we may have our own different focuses and, you know, have our own laws and purpose of being, but look, we're all, you know, kind of the same general paradigm. And so what they were really doing was they were trying to create a system that allowed them to have their differences. This is why when states came into the Union, it was, you know, we the people had the requirement of foreordaining, or I should say, basically self-determination when we started creating. And that's what ended up happening when you started looking at some of the states. Some of the states actually started growing, or I should say, people started moving west. And as those territories formed into states, those people that went out there, they were the ones that influenced it.
Okay.
And what was interesting is when we look at Missouri, at the, you know, in the early days, you know, Missouri was actually being propagated by people, but the majority of the people that were out there, they were just out there for themselves. They weren't out there as a franchise of slavery. There were only a few people that really, you know, wanted, they didn't have enough. They did not have enough in consensus of wanting slavery to actually allow the people the ability to self-determine that Missouri would be a free state. And so those who were invested in the slave franchise that was in Missouri recognized that they were going to have a real problem unless they came up with a solution, and they proposed the Missouri Compromise. Correct. Those people who were financing and wanting to be able to maintain their slavery franchise. You know, you got to realize that as Alabama or as these states were growing, even though there may have been land, the best land was always being purchased and acquired by, you know, those people who had the money to do that.
Right.
You know, they were doing land speculation long before Thomas Jefferson even came along.
Right.
Okay. So these men knew the value, especially in the agrarian society. They understood the value of land was very important, a very rich, fertile valley. Oh, this is the prime area for being able to grow crops. So the person that laid down their claim to that or, you know, was able to purchase that, then they were the ones that were well set to be able to, you know, knock production out of the park, so to speak. So anyway, so as we look at America, and as the as this people started having to face, because the real question was, why were they taking consideration of actually severing themselves, or I should say arresting their own people? So the Tories were those who chose not. In other words, what was the whole point of the Revolutionary War? We were Englishmen. These people in these colonies were Englishmen, and they were being denied their rights.
And they
couldn't fathom how their fellow colonists were okay with that.
Okay.
And they said, you know, if you think that we're second class, that you're not deserving of, you know, the rights of an Englishman, then you don't deserve to be here.
Right. Okay. So that was the motivation.
Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Today, we have marginalized our citizenship so much that we, you know, anybody can be a citizen. They could be an enemy to the Constitution, and they could be a citizen. And yet, when we look at the laws of the militia, the laws of, you know, our security and our system of defending the Constitution, how could we even allow any person to exist as a citizen that does not understand their responsibility of defending and protecting the Constitution?
So that's been lost, GR. I remember learning something about the Constitution in high school so well that I was able to repeat
the preamble, or
the preamble 30 years later, having not seen it before. I did it for a high school class, okay? And I got it word perfect. So they don't even do that anymore. The Constitution has been so de-emphasized in education that, you know, ask an adult on the street under 30 anything about how our system of government works, okay? And I will tell you, more often than not, you'll get ignorance. Okay, they'll be clueless, and that's unfortunate. I can't say that's true for all of them, but if they're not ignorant, they're not getting it from the education system, right?
Right. Well, so When you look at people recognizing the importance of education, Martin Luther himself actually did that, right? Didn't he point to the fact that, you know, with this bad education that they were receiving, you know, that they were, you know, I just recently remember reading, and let me pull it up here. This is Martin Luther. "I am very much afraid that schools will prove to be the great gates of hell unless they diligently labor in explaining the Holy Scriptures, engraving them in the hearts of youth. I advise no one." As a matter of fact, remember, the education system was, and the whole free academia was, and even Isaac Newton, the duty of science was to prove the existence of God. Anytime that somebody in the name of science tries to prove that God doesn't exist is a corrupted scientist. That was Isaac Newton's paradigm.
Wow.
So, I mean, this goes, that was back in the 1500s. We're you know, a half a millennia later, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's 500 years ago when Martin Luther was making those comments. And it was 300 some years ago when Sir Isaac Newton was doing that. So the school system is designed to either elevate society or debase it. And our school system today is functioning, it is taking on the function and role of debasing our society. As a matter of fact, I used to have, I think it's still maybe up there, an old reference to how many kids are in the school system today. In other words, we've got millions of kids that are being programmed and weaponized to actually abandon liberty and abandon our constitutional republic because they're not being taught the importance of liberty and the ability to choose for ourselves and the beauty of having a self-governing system.
Yeah.
So we got, I know you got a couple of other questions, so let's hold you over for tomorrow's show, because I've got less than a minute left, and so
you actually answered them, because the next one had to do with persons, you know, being treated like they're treasonous, and you just went through that.
Okay.
You just went through, you know, arresting the agitators and treasonous, you covered it. You know, I asked one question,
so,
and you answered three.
So here's the question. Are these people who are surrendering their citizenship, let me just tie you over, and then we can talk about, and actually, you know, I think we can come up with a couple of things to talk about, because next week I'm going to actually dive into the convention argument, you know, the anti-conventionites and the conventionites. And so we'll bring you back tomorrow and we'll kind of look forward to that and talk. I want to bring back this conversation of what do we do with citizens who are actually abandoning their citizenship, walking away from their responsibility of defending the Constitution. And so, because I think that what we're looking at, the whole focus of the last couple of days was to point to the General Assembly, the sovereign citizens, and how close they are to actually being treasonous. Anyway, we will be back tomorrow, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.